everybody. Welcome into another episode of the Comics Experience Make Comics Podcast, a show where we talk about the nuts and bolts of making comics. I'm Joey Groh. Today I'm talking to Andy Schmidt of Comics Experience fame, as well as IDW, Marvel. He's written video games. He's written and creative directed on cartoons that we all know and love. He's done so many things, but of course I just want to talk to him about turkey, or lack of turkey.
I did have some turkey.
Well, today we are going to be talking about adaptations or not adaptations, or am I making something that is for comics? Is my idea for prose? Is my idea better suited for a TV or video game? Is it all of those? And I actually wanted to pose this question to you because it's something I've been thinking about recently when you have ideas and wondering, well, you know, could I write a prose novel? Could I write a short story? You know, is this something that feels more like a comic, or could this be a movie script? Is that something I want to try to do? And I think that, you know, comics and film and TV have always had like adaptations and can go back and forth. Or we know, you know, the number of folks that I just know through CE, like a Philip Kennedy Johnson had a creator owned comic get option for Netflix to go into production of something that he wrote and created. It's stuff getting adapted, I guess, is one thing, but starting off from a point of here's my idea. Is it something that is a comic? Is it something that I don't want to make just a comic to feel like a movie pitch? But I mentioned also before we were rolling that I got Maddie in the mail from the Kickstarter from Duncan Jones and the team that worked with him, the film director and writer, that he had an idea for a movie that he turned into a massive OGN that he produced with comics artists and Alex DeCampi as a writer with him on this massive OGN that they released. You know, how do you go from that decision? Is it, well, I want to get the story out and get it told, but I can't get it greenlit for the money because it's a big concept and it's sci-fi, versus I could have made this into a novel. This could be something that I spun out in prose. And you've got a background in dealing with lots of different medias.
Yeah,
mediums. So comics, animation, as well as video games, as well as some prose, and especially on some of the license work you've worked
and
on.
And some live action stuff too. So, this is one of those things, you know, I get this a lot. You know, we do a Comics Experience. One of the services we offer, in addition, I mean, we're most well known for our courses and master seminars and things like that. But we also do creative services. So let's say you're a writer and you've got a script and you want to turn it into a comic book, and you come to us, and then you know, we basically project manage that. We'll find artists and we'll, you know, we'll do the whole thing. Anyway, the point is, a lot of folks that come to me go, I have a screenplay and I want to convert it to a comic book because then it'll help me sell the screenplay or whatever. And that always, it's not that that can't work, right? But it's a red flag for me right off the bat, because if you created something that's supposed to be a movie, that's different than a comic. And most of the time when somebody comes and says, I created a screenplay, I want to turn it into a comic, even if they've written a comic book script, it still resembles the movie. And like, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's easier to get into like a specific, right? So like in an action movie, I did a creator owned comic called 5 Days to Die, and I had a car chase scene in it, right? Car chase scenes work great in television film. That's why there are so many of them. Mm-hmm. Right? It's really kinetic and frenetic, and the camera jumbles around, moves around. It's very exciting. In comics, which are static images, they're terrible. Right.
Right.
So when I put one in 5 Days to Die, I did that as a challenge. It's like, hey, can I make a car chase scene in a comic interesting and entertaining and kinetic? And the answer to that was sort of like, better than most other car chase scenes. But like, we had to get pretty creative of how we did it. It also didn't last very long in terms of page count. It was like 3 pages, maybe. And like, as quickly as possible, I got those characters out of the car because I realized it's just, you know, they're in cars, and that's, you know, it's a picture of somebody sitting there. Even if they're cranking the wheel to the left, you still don't have that motion, right? So anyway, every medium has its strengths, every medium has its weaknesses. So when somebody comes and says, I got this screenplay, I want to do it as a comic, it's a red flag. It doesn't mean it doesn't work. can't work, shouldn't work, but it's a point of discussion, right? And sometimes, you know, I'll you know, take a look at what they've done or whatever, and I'll say, you know, you're going to wind up making a bad comic and give somebody a bad comic to try and sell your good movie. It's not a great way to do it. If you can make a really great comic, then they'll figure out a way to adapt it into a movie and, you know, with your screenplay attached, right? You know, potentially. So, but the idea of making a mediocre, not a bad comic, you know, but making a mediocre comic or something that doesn't use the medium properly and then using that to sell something that's more expensive is just, I think that's a tough proposition.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the ways in which I sort of try to figure out, you know, because a lot of times I have story ideas and I don't know, is this going to be a prose thing? Is it going to be a comic? Am I going to write as a screenplay, give it to my manager and my folks out in LA or whatever? But I kind of go through a process of determining, you know, what the best medium is. And there's more than, I mean, of course there's more than just what is the best medium. Like there's budgetary concerns. There's, you know, anytime I'm talking about something as a TV animation or a feature film, you know, I'm calling my folks in LA and being like, here's the idea. Is it worth developing this? Or is there some reason I don't know about that the answer is no? And sometimes they'll say, yeah, I wouldn't do that one. Right. Because it's, you know, because it's, you know, if the budget would be too big or, you know, there's something in the works that I didn't know about already that's similar enough to it, whatever it might be, you know. So, and the same thing with prose and comics. I mean, one of the major advantages of prose is that it's the least expensive to produce and you don't need a special effects budget at all, right? In comics, your budget is the page, more or less the page count and how much you're paying per page for art and that sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And there's the publishing cost, the printing cost, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, like for Universal Pictures or Fox or Disney or whatever, they can look at a comic and be like, oh yeah, that's nothing, right? Compared to a $150 million budget for
right.
a movie. But for us mere mortals, it's still a lot of money.
Right.
So obviously that's going to be a concern unless you just happen to be independently wealthy and have a lot of money to burn, which is great. But, you know, so those things do factor in. But, you know, a lot of what I've worked on, too, is this thing is successful as one thing. Can it be successful as another? Or how do you do it that way? And before this call, you had mentioned, you know, some of the things that I've worked on in terms of adaptations or things that worked in more than one media. And video games is a whole nother animal completely. But when I was working on Star Trek comics and I got told, okay, you're going to take over the Star Trek franchise, I started reading Star Trek comics. And the problem that I had with most Star Trek comics was that they read like episodes of the show, which you think is a pretty decent approach. Fans of the show would then like the comic, except when you think about that show, you know, prior to the current series Discovery and, you know, Picard, when you think about the traditional Star Trek shows, so to speak, mm-hmm. they're essentially stage plays, right? It's a bunch of guys standing in a room, standing on a stage, talking with each other, and occasionally talking to a giant TV monitor.
Right.
And then every once in a while, there's something else. You know, you've got an away team or whatever, right? But for a lot of that show, it's people just standing around talking. And when you do that in a comic, you don't have the actors' body language, you don't have their facial expressions that change their little tics, you don't have their tone of voice, the way they turn a phrase, you don't have all of those things that make Picard, right, just doesn't translate when you put it in a comic and you just have a bunch of talking heads page after page. So when I was talking with the folks at Paramount, I said, CBS, Paramount, whatever they are now, you know, what I said to them is, okay, we're going to do some Star Trek comics, but they're not going to look like, the TV show anymore. They're going to be different. They're like, well, what do you mean? I was like, well, they'll still be Star Trek. There'll be people out doing stuff.
Right.
And like, there was a little hesitancy, like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, you know, it's the away teams. Like, the focus will be on the away teams. We're going to put them in more dangerous situations. You know, we're going to do more action oriented type stuff with them. And they're like, well, as long as it's still, you know, yeah, it'll be cerebral. It'll still be about, you know, the greatness that mankind can achieve and, you know, a brighter future. Like, it'll still be about all those things. It'll still be Star Trek. It'll just be converted to a medium so that instead of having good Star Trek TV shows and diet Star Trek TV shows told in comic book form, you'll hopefully have good Star Trek TV shows and good Star Trek comics. Right. But then there was a whole process I had to go through, and I wound up watching, at the time there were the 10 Star Trek movies, the six with the original cast, and then, you know, Generations and you know, the three after that with the Next Generation cast.
Right.
And I watched all 10 of those. And then I watched all of the commentary tracks on all 10, and I took notes. A lot of notes about what made them. And the reason I was focusing on the films is because they have more action, right? There's more going on, the bigger budget, blah, blah, blah. So I was kind of looking at them for how do we do it and keep it Star Trek. And so I took a lot of notes, and there's stuff in that movie that as you may know, don't work great. Some of those movies are not excellent, but some of them are great. You know, it runs a gamut. So, like, I just took a lot of notes about, like, what makes Star Trek Star Trek. And as long as we could tell stories that were true to the characters and true to the themes, and had the tropes, the locations, and the ship, of course, had to be a thing. And like, once I got a very clear sense of what was in a Star Trek basket, I could, you know, we could change the basket. Right. The basket itself could change. It didn't have to be a woven basket. It could now be a steel bucket.
Right. Right.
It could be your 5-gallon basket from Lowe's or Home Depot's. As long as what was in that basket was the core Star Trek stuff, you're good. Right. And that was sort of how I kind of explained it to Paramount. And
yeah.
They were more or less okay with it. And I got a lot fewer questions. Like, I co-wrote, it was a one shot called Star Trek Spotlight Cardassians, that I co-wrote, and it was all action. It was all like dudes running around invading a station. And they were like, this is weird for a Star Trek thing. I'm like, yeah, but it's all based in this Deep Space Nine lore and all this sort of stuff. It's very Star Trek-y. and they eventually were like, oh yeah, this is really fun. But once they saw it on the page, they were like, this was a really fun comic, you know. You know, it didn't blow their minds or whatever. But anyway, you know, so you can take a thing conceptually, and you can, you know, one of the things that we talk about in the intro to writing class is how a story is a story, right? When you boil a story down, it hasn't chosen its medium yet, or you haven't chosen and formed it for a medium, but you can control that aspect if you understand the media that you want to use. So if you've got a story idea and you want to develop it for a comic, you can do that if you know how what makes for a good comic. Then you know how to develop it specifically shooting for a comic book, right? Or you can do a more free associative sort of thing, figure out that ultimately what you want to tell and blow it out and get all the details around it, and then take a look at it, dissect it, and go, oh, with these component parts and with these types of scenes and these types of characters and blah, 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 this should be a prose novel.
Right.
Or it should be a film. Like, either approach is fine. I don't think that – I think it's totally fine to design a story for a specific medium. If you want to work in comics, develop comics.
Right.
But just understand how to do that. And that's – some of that will come through time and practice. Some of it comes through studying. Like, I study stories of – all kinds, right? You know, so right now I'm reading the novels for The Expanse, right? Which is also a TV show on was on Sci-Fi, now it's on Amazon Prime. And I started by watching the television show. I hadn't even heard of the book series. Got really into the show, started reading the novels, and I've been surprised how faithful the television show is of an adaptation to the novels. But it works really well. But now that I'm reading the novels, I'm seeing what changes they made for the show. And 9 times out of 10, they made really smart decisions based on the fact that they were making a television show.
Right. As you would have to.
Not a movie or not a... Right. Yeah. But that's actually pretty rare. Like, the best example of adaptation gone... seemingly gone right, but gone horribly wrong, is the 2009 Watchmen film.
Right.
Which is, on some level, like an extraordinarily faithful adaptation of that graphic novel. Like,
right,
shot for shot, word for word, through most of the thing. But it completely misses the point.
Right.
Right. Like, it just, it doesn't work. And part of the reason it doesn't work is because some of the changes they made. But a lot of the reasons that it doesn't work is because they didn't make changes.
I think that was the key in watching it, too. Something, and maybe you disagree, but something like, the third act dealing with nuclear war versus giant space squid. Like, I get that as a creative decision. But to your point, it was just too much trying to not have those changes into a film.
Right. Yeah, I think. But also a lot of it, too, is that it's one thing to read first person narration for 45, 50 pages. Because it was 12 issues, but it's really broken into 6 sort of slices, right? And each slice is one character, right? So you've got, the first 2 issues that are really about the comedian, and then 3 and 4 about Dr. Manhattan, and they're narrated by Dr. Manhattan, and then it's narrated by Rorschach, and so on and so forth. And it's one thing to read that. It's another thing to sit there and have somebody actually speak it.
Right.
Right. And so the first time I saw that movie, I really enjoyed large chunks of it because it was like, this is what Rorschach sounds like. And for half that movie, I'm just waiting for Rorschach to say, "You don't understand. I'm not locked up in here with you.
Right.
You're locked up in here with me." And when that moment came, I was primed for it because I love that graphic novel. I love that moment. Right. But then it drags on. Like, it was exciting to see the comic on the screen, but when you go back for second viewing and the nostalgia of that is gone on a second viewing, the whole thing just hangs terribly. Whereas the most recent HBO show, which, if you haven't seen it, is phenomenal, is incredibly faithful to Watchmen, and yet doesn't have a single scene from the book.
Right.
Like, thematically, and what makes it Watchmen is Watchmen. And there's a whole bunch of some great stuff in the interviews with I'm blanking on his name, the guy who
Damon Lindelof
Lindelof, where he's like, he's even talking about like the fact that like Alan Moore doesn't want anything to do with these things and doesn't want it, and like, so there's like an appropriation thing, and so they use, like, we're appropriating work by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. Dave apparently is cool with it. Alan Moore less so.
Right.
So he's like, so he even ties that in to the show itself and uses appropriation of Rorschach's mask as part of the show's DNA. Like, I mean, it's like, it's fascinating. And most of it comes from the book, but then he also took some from this, or he and the writers, took this stuff from real life situations too.
An interesting thing about some of that background too is the writers, some of the writers were unfamiliar with comics and didn't know the comics. And I think that serves that particular adaptation, might be in a category by itself, really well, that you could have somebody come in, then read it, and then work on an episodic television show based on it. That's not somebody that grew up, like me. It's like, Watchmen is sacred. How do you do Watchmen? And they made a show that was super relevant. And like you said, tied into all the themes, but isn't lifting imagery or set pieces. And yet still has some character overlaps and all the influences that it has. And it feels like Watchmen, except 30 years later on a TV show.
Right. And at the time that Watchmen came out in 86 and 87, like, all the socio-political stuff that's in that book was super relevant.
Right. Like,
no other superhero comic, you know, mainstream superhero comic had managed to do anything like that and managed to be commenting on society as all of that was being, as society was going through sort of this churning, this cold war stuff.
Right.
And I think the thing that shocked me maybe the most about how good that show was is that television show did the same thing, but for today, with today's issues and with the Black Lives Matter movement and this new sort of surge of racism and which I, maybe it's a surge. Racism's not new, obviously, but
right,
you know, how it's been sort of coming back, you know, more publicly and all that, you know, all this sort of stuff. And it just, the fact that they made a Watchmen show that came out in, I guess, 2019, technically, that that was just as culturally relevant as the graphic novel was in 1986 was sort of mind-boggling.
Right.
But that's in the Watchmen DNA, right? It's not dealing with the same issues. Like, that, the show doesn't work if it's dealing with Cold War, right? Cold War's not even a thing.
Right, right.
So, but they understood what was behind the Cold War, and they managed to twist and replicate and come up with something new that's culturally relevant today. Otherwise, it just falls flat on its face. And Watchmen's kind of unique in that how much of its time period it really is tied to. But
sure.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I've worked on some big franchises, you know, some stuff like Transformers and G.I. Joe, and I've worked on them in multiple media to various degrees. And, you know, it's really difficult. Like, there's the discussion of what makes a thing part of the franchise. When I was editing, before I actually worked at Hasbro and was working on multiple media of franchises simultaneously, I was working at IDW, and I was in charge of editorially directing the Transformers and G.I. Joe. And one of the things that they had asked was that I push the boundaries on what a Transformers story could be. Which I like doing that, because what it requires you to do, and this is just stuff that I really enjoy doing, is it requires you to figure out what makes, you know, like we're talking about with Star Trek and Watchmen, what makes Transformers Transformers. And once you understand what the key elements are, you also understand what the elements are that you can shed, right?
Right.
And so we wound up experimenting with the types of stories, and our hardcore fans weren't super thrilled.
Right.
Because they, generally speaking, want stuff that feels very familiar, but newish, right? But generally, they want it to feel and sound like the stuff that they have already seen and read.
Sure.
So there were some places where we pushed on the boundaries where I think some of the pushback we got was valid, that the pushback was valid. And there were other places where, you know, I take a look at it and be like, no, in this case, you know, and it's not just like my opinion, right? I mean, I'd have to actually like look at stuff. You know, I wrote up a lot of documents about what makes a Transformers thing. But we did basically a police procedural story in the main Transformers book with a character Prowl, who's a police car, you know, being detective, and it was kind of great. You know, it was, because it, you know, you actually took elements of Transformers and used them. One of the things about Transformers in comics, in the cartoon, they would change into cars and roll out and all that stuff. And but again, cars, vehicles, comics don't work. In the comics, they're like robots, like all the time. There's like an establishing shot of them rolling into town, and then they're all transformed into robots, because robots are more emotive and interesting to look at than the cars. But yeah, it was just really interesting, like seeing what kind of pushback we got from fans. But then also, you know, at the same time talking to Hasbro, and Hasbro was like, no, keep doing more of this. Like, so at the, you know, which puts me in a weird position, right? Because I need those fans to buy those comics, because the publishing company, IDW, is paying my salary. So I need sales to be healthy.
Right.
In order for IDW to be happy. But Hasbro wants me to push boundaries. So could I find a way to do both? And we did. You know, what I wound up doing is we were usually putting out two or three Transformers comics a month. And, you know, I kind of had three buckets. I had one that was like, this one's for Hasbro, this one's for IDW and like casual meat and potatoes Transformers fans, and then this one's for the super fan. Right. So I kind of, you know, and so it was fascinating when we launched these, when we relaunched, it was a soft relaunch for Transformers, but when we relaunched them, the first three comics came out fit very specifically in those buckets. And immediately the diehard fans went to this book called Last Stand of the Wreckers, and they loved it and they still talk about it, but I was put on a spit and burned at the stake for some of the other stuff that I had done. And it was funny to watch, you know, on message boards and stuff, how I was being demonized and blamed for all the stuff that they hated in the other one or two books. But I was given zero credit for anything that they liked, and they loved this other one, Last Stand of the Wreckers. And it was interesting. And fortunately I didn't take it real personally. But it was interesting to watch all of that.
A good advice in general, but yeah, I'm sure seeing it in motion was a completely different thing. Well, I think, you know, you touched on figuring out your story and then evaluating it. And I think that seems to be kind of the big meat and potatoes takeaway, is seeing how it works. And, you know, I watched a little bit of The Expanse, but now I'm kind of curious to do what you're doing. Just as an exercise to pick up the books at the same time or after watching the show and seeing the differences, because I think that can really also help inform, like, oh, why did they, you know, making me think critically about why were these changes maybe made, and not being a part of the creative process for that show. I'm sure it's, you know, some speculation, but you can also reach out and, you know, read and see why something might have been made. If they talk about, like, oh, well, we dropped this character because there were too many characters, or we figured this character could carry their motivation and some of their storyline, but also make the plot go. And
yeah, one of the changes that's most interesting with The Expanse is that in season one, one of the main characters isn't in the first book. So the first book is actually the first like season and a half. So it goes well into season two, and they took this one character, Avasarala, who premieres in the novels in book two, which starts halfway through season two and goes, I think, halfway through season three. But now she's in the entire first season of the show and the first half of the second season, which she has not appeared in the books yet for any of that time. But they knew that she was going to be an important character. So she's in, I think she's in episode one of the first season, and you watch that show and you wouldn't think that there would be any reason not to include her. And so that's probably the single biggest change that I've noticed, you know, having read two and a half of the novels. But yeah, there's a lot more, and there's some things too, like where characters kind of come in and out of the show, and I wasn't sure if that was actually the case in the book, or were they popular on the show and so they would come back later because they were popular characters or whatnot. It was so that all of that's been sort of, you know, been really interesting. And you know, I have a pretty good friend who wrote for the first three seasons of the show, so every once in a while I'll shoot her an email and ask her some questions about, like, hey, what was the thinking behind this, just because I'm fascinated by that kind of stuff. You know.
Yeah, the process to understand the what and the why, for sure. Right. Well, any other thoughts come to mind? We can wrap this up. Anything else? As I think it's good to hear your experience and how you've had to work in different mediums to work in different mediums.
Well, I think if you're a writer or an artist, I think knowing what medium you want to shoot for and get most proficient at is probably a good idea. Like, I came up through comics, but I've written several video games now, and I've done a lot of brand and franchise development and reconstruction or revision and that sort of stuff, you know, analysis, I guess. You know, I do a lot of that kind of work now, and I've done prose, and the basics of story, the fundamentals don't really change, But I think finding a focus, you know, I do run into a lot of people that are like, oh yeah, I write everything. And, you know, if you're a savant, that's great. which exists. I mean, you might be. I don't know.
Yeah. People do a number of different things.
But if you're focusing on any one medium, you're still going to learn the fundamentals. And so once you get really good and you really understand a medium really well and how it works and what makes it tick and what makes the scene turn and all that sort of stuff, a lot of that is going to apply when you move over to another medium. But you know, one of the reason I got into video games is because I, you know, Hasbro would recommend me for things with their brands because they considered me an expert on their brands, and I was a writer and they trusted me. So when the video game people would say, who do you recommend that we talk to? They would recommend me. So I'm going into that video game with some advantages. And not just that I was recommended, which is nice. Thank you guys. But I'm going into that with an advantage because I know the franchise.
Right. Right.
I know these characters already. And so I'm bringing something that folks putting that video game, I'm sure there were Transformers fans on all these, but like, you know, that weren't bringing. So I was bringing an expertise outside of creating the video game and more than just being able to craft a story. So I knew how to craft story and I knew these characters really well. And I knew the lore and everything. And that kicked me in. And that meant that I was having a lot of conversations with them, you know, certainly for the first video game of, okay, how do you want this written? You know, and they flat out would just tell me, like, this is the format I want to give it. You know, I want you to do this for these scenes. They sent me spreadsheets for dialogue, which I'm like, I'm writing dialogue in spreadsheets. But it made total sense once I realized, you know, there, you know, a lot of the spreadsheets were mainly for, maybe entirely for, like, when characters, you know, this was like an action game, you know, first person, like,
sure,
you know, shooter type game. So when you know, you would get hit by a rocket since you're a walking tank, right? You know, you could say, ow, or you could say, you know, they had to have like seven different things that you would say when you got shot, because you get shot a lot and you can't just say the same thing over and over, right? And then my job would be, okay, well, how do I make Hound getting shot sound like Hound? Like, what would he say that's different than what Bumblebee says, or what Optimus Prime says, or what Soundwave says, or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. So, but anyway, my point is, focus, my advice for most writers is to focus on one medium, learn how to tell a story really well for that one medium and get really good at that, and then branch out. Now, that doesn't mean don't pay attention to other media. If you play video games, pay attention to how the narratives work, because you can always pick up pieces. But in terms of honing your craft, hone your craft in one thing first, and then, you know, get good at that, and then start to branch out after that. A lot of folks I know are like, I want to write a video game, and it's just really hard to learn how to narratively write a video game, because you're not going to be making a lot of narrative decisions. In most cases, you know, with a video game, the video game designers that are doing all the leveling and all that, you know, figuring out all, like, story narrative is often, not always, but often one of the last things that gets figured out. It's like, this is the game. This is how you play it. This is all the things you have to do, right? These are all the missions, you know, all the things you have to accomplish to get to the end and beat the bad guys. And then they'll come to a writer and be like, okay, make a story out of it. Right. And then you're like, oh, okay, well, all right, let me dig in, you know. And that's, but, you know, it's very, very rare that a writer is brought on early in a video game and that you actually help craft the video game, just as an example.
Well, I think that all makes sense, because there's obviously different assignments that come up, and knowing how stuff is put together in different mediums is also a good tool to have just in general, but especially when it comes to paying work and getting involved in projects. You've got some comics coming out, which I think the last time you were on were announced, and you have got a release date you can talk about?
Yeah. Yes, I do. Generations Shattered, which is an 80-page giant comic, co-written by me and also Rob Vendetti and Dan Juergens, is coming out on January 6th. It'll be in comic shops on January 6th. So please, if you're a comics fan and you're listening to this, which you probably are, if you're listening to this, please tell your retailer that you want a copy, or seven or eight. Let us know what you think about it. I'd be curious to hear feedback on it. It's a really cool story. It's sort of a time travel-y thing that celebrates the various generations of DC Comics. And so there's going to be some surprises in there, I think, for old-time fans, but it should be really fun for even fresh fans as well, because hopefully if we did our job right, you're not just totally lost. You'll get a sense of who these characters are as we're going with the story. But and that's part one. Part two, a second 80-page giant called Generations Forged, comes out at the end of February. So it's January, the first week of January, and I think the last week of February is when the second 80-page giant comes out. And it's got all kinds of super cool artists are involved too. So if you've I'm actually going to pull up the credits page here and take a look, because I don't want to leave anybody out. But it has got just an amazing list of artists. Ivan Rice with Joe Prado, and Scott Hanna, Fernando Passerin. I may not have said that last name correctly. He's amazing. Aaron Lopresti, Emanuela Lupacino. She's awesome. Bernard Chang, Yannick Paquette, Kevin Nowlan, Dan Jurgens, who was also one of the co-writers on it, Paul Pelletier, John Romita Jr., Doug Braithwaite, Brian Hitch, and Mike Perkins, all on the first issue. And then there's all kinds of crazy guys on the second issue as well. So we're celebrating the history of the DC universe. We're celebrating all these different artists as well. And it should be a lot of fun for folks. So please check it out.
That is a murderer's row of artists too. And
they're really, really, really good.
It's 160 pages between those. I'm an English major, but I believe it's 160 pages between those two 80 page giants.
Yeah. And that's just the artist on the first one.
That's nuts. That's great. And Comics Experience, we've got Intro to Comic Book Coloring coming up in January. We've got Introduction to Visual Storytelling with Philip Seavey, who's been on recently. And, of course, Intro to Comic Book Coloring is with Chris Sotomayor, who's been on this year as well. And then Introduction to Writing Comics with Paul Aller and then someone else, Andy Schmidt. Yeah, we'll kick off in January. So plenty of opportunities to get your comics started. And then, of course, you can see all the other courses that are offered at CE, as well as the workshop. And that's always moving and always going 24 hours, 7 days a week, even on your holidays like a Thanksgiving. It's a great place to go and get your feet wet to learn about making comics or ask some questions, make some friends, see if there's folks you can collaborate with. There's lots of things you can do over there in the forums, or just talk about whatever. If you have a question you want to hear talked about on the show, email info@comicsexperience.com or tweet @comicexperience on Twitter, or you can even Facebook message. We get those from time to time. Go to Facebook and find Comics Experience on Facebook. And until next time, keep making comics.